This is May 30th, 2006. The sixth session, tape, no, side two. Side two, the sixth session, May 30th, 2006. So I was saying about Joseph Conrad that he was known, but the world of surveillance was happening in the teens and 20s, at least within visual culture.
But I'm just saying, for the everyman, it wasn't happening to the hyped up paranoid level that Orwell projected.
But if you take Orwell's 94 as the management of three different regions on the planet, right?
Uh-huh.
And how on the secret level they were all the same group, even though to the occupants and citizens of each of the three groups, they thought the other group was an enemy or that there were terrorists out to get him, and that the idea the terrorists worked for Big Brother and were a fake enemy, that situation was already happening in the teens and 20s and 30s in media culture of Europe, or even Hoover, FBI in the 20s and 30s. You know, the problem with the anarchists and the communists and the bank robbers, it was all media projections.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a mediated world back then in the first part of the 20th century. And Orwell's world, Orwell 1984, is a mediated world. But the McLuhan is trying, anything that could have happened, there's a nuclear war, and 1984 comes after the nuclear war in Orwell's book. But McLuhan is saying that with electronic media, everybody's been angelized and discarnate. That's way beyond what Orwell's chemical body concerns of surveillance are. So McLuhan is trying to say your images of what you think is bad or good are nowhere near how greatly huge volumes of intensity are happening compared to the images and intensity of Orwell in terms of the effect on previous media and the chemical body. So the next line, which is from Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations, a book that McLuhan put out in 1957. It was the eighth edition of his journal Explorations. And this one was written totally by McLuhan, basically. There were a few essays by other people, but Carpenter wasn't involved in this issue. He has a quote, "Not Big Brother is watching, but all the brothers." And that's called item 15 in the book, Verbi Vocal Visual Explorations. So, again, I'm putting that in there, juxtaposed with what he says about Orwell, to start to give you an idea of what is going on here. What does McLuhan mean by a big brother that's well past Orwellian conditions? So then you come to the next quote, which is from the letters of McLuhan, and it was written in 1969, it's on page 370 of the letters of McLuhan. So if you read that, where he says, electric information environments being utterly ethereal, read that again, electric information environments being utterly ethereal fosters the illusion of the world as spiritual substance. It is now a, meaning the electric world, it is now a reasonable facsimile of the mystical body, a blatant manifestation of the Antichrist. After all, the prince of this world is a very great electric engineer. So he's saying we're already into the biblical end times, if you take it literally that the Antichrist shows up in end times. In the 50s and 60s, he's saying we're already in the world of the Antichrist. So that's I bring that up to say there are bigger ramifications of the TV world and the satellite world that Orwell doesn't get anywhere close with his projections.
Yeah. Well, I see that.
So that's the reason why I'm juxtaposing these quotes. The next quote continues the prince of this world, the Antichrist theme, and this is on page 387 of the letters, and the quote is, there's no harm in reminding ourselves from time to time that the prince of this world is a great PR man, a great salesman of new hardware and software, a great electric engineer, and a great master of the media. It is his, meaning the Antichrist, it is his masterstroke to be not only environmental, but invisible. For the environmental is invincibly persuasive when ignored. So he's trying to say that Orwell's projection is too visible. It's too familiar. It's too understandable.
Yeah.
McLuhan's saying the real Big Brother is not even recognized, what he calls an invisible environment.
Right, and he's anthropomorphizing it by calling it the Prince of the World or the Great PR Man. It's not. He's not talking about persons or peoples or a person.
Oh, yes, he is. Now, he's writing this in the late 60s. The digital Android meme's starting to come in, where we're going to get the AP brought back, where the media shrinks and one person can run the whole world. And I say that's the White House. So we are now getting the Big Brother bureaucracy or the corporations or the media managements and their environments, whatever networks they form to create a kind of social control, that can be focused around one man. And so the president is the main image of that from Kennedy on, at least. And so it is down to one person. But that person is not just a chemical body. He's the other bodies, or she. You know what I mean? He's a mixture of all the bodies. We are beginning to get the Rumpelstiltskin effect. By the 90s, everybody becomes Rumpelstiltskin. Everybody becomes an Antichrist with their mixed media computers. In terms of information spamming.
Okay. Yeah.
And many people in the 70s and 80s said that Orwell's image of the future was not as strong as Aldous Huxley's Brave New World scenario. And that was before AIDS, they said that. But when you got the devastation of AIDS and how that kind of put a kink in the arse of the hedonistic chemical body celebrations of the 60s and 70s, then you get into the weakness of both Orwell and Huxley. And that's where you bring in McLuhan as describing what's going on more than these guys. And he's building on Wyndham Lewis and his projections. But by the 90s, when you have the wall go down and the so-called unpredictable end of the Cold War, that's when the McLuhan revival comes back. They didn't retrieve Orwell or Huxley. They retrieved McLuhan as the one who had the vision closest to the world of 1989, 90, and 91.
Yeah. Now, last week you made a statement to the effect that when the wall went down, the global theater ended. Would you stand by that?
Yeah. Would I stand by it?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, everything disappeared. In other words, the cold, when everything disappeared, how's that registered for the chemical body and the TV body? Oh, it's the end of the Cold War. Because in the TV body, that was the main content fabricated conflictual situation, was the superpowers, right? The conflict of the superpowers. So the end of the TV body with 1990 ends the Cold War image, but it's the end of a lot of bigger scenarios than just the problem between two superpowers, which is, call that a chemical body problem, and an astral body problem. But the TV body was obsolete, and the chip body dominated in the 90s. And then by 2000, the chip body was wiped out. And what's interesting, look at the speed of change. TV body had 30 years, 50 to, well, maybe 40 years, 50 to 90. The chip body only had 10 years before its walls were knocked down, or new walls were built around it.
And the chip body was knocked down by the retrieval of the AP?
Yes, the post-information, post-chip world, which is the chip landscape becoming a tiny body and then people interacting based on nothing.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that because of the miniaturization of the circuitry or because of another reason?
No, the compression and miniaturization, the shrinking down of vast and mediated environments.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kids...
You're not just talking about the image of a chip on a circuit board that they're physically making smaller and smaller chips and putting more and more transistors in smaller and smaller chips.
No, that's the hardware constituent or a part of the process, but its effect in other media is that it makes other media shrink.
Uh-huh. Right, because fewer and fewer people can control larger and larger environments.
That's one part of it, but the environments that they're controlling are encouraging the users of those environments to think that they control the environment.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. The like you were saying earlier with MySpace.
Yeah.
Were we talking about that on this tape or off the tape? But the MySpace thing, where
that
you have
on the tape.
Yeah, you have. We have the feeling that we're that it's giving us, it's conferring to us the feeling of that we're controlling the media.
Oh, I think that was before the tape, that particular part. But we talked about the new medium of MySpace on the tape.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I was talking about the general principle of compression and the Android meme seducing you into making you feel not on the margins anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You're at the center of the action.
Yeah.
That's why people, you just look at how much people use a cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them a great sense of power. They can talk to anybody anytime and have a a digression, a diversion, and an interaction with another spirit, instantly.
Yeah. But it's
before
it's
that.
It's still. I'm here and you're there, and we're sending information back and forth. What's going to happen when you can jump? When they can hook a thing up to your brain, your neurotransmitters on your brain, and project you into a virtual reality, where you think you're talking to someone who doesn't even exist?
That'll be no problem, because you're already doing that, but you're talking about the management of the chemical body and the management maybe of the chip body and the TV body, and then you would say that they merge and shrink, and then you have the new AP, or just the AP, the being, and you're worried about the being not having any control over its making faculty, its consciousness generation.
Yeah, well, let's say you go into virtual reality and they give you a set of controls and you have the feeling that you're controlling your participation within virtual reality, but it's just, they're just altering, they're just reassembling your neurotransmitters in a way to project what looks to you like a three-dimensional, you know, world, but it has no interface at all with the world that you and I are embodied in at the moment.
Right. Now, that's the Matrix scenario.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in the movie The Matrix, the guys, the New Yorkers all thought they lived in New York. They didn't. They lived in a tube, right?
Yeah.
And they were dreaming it.
Right.
So, I'm saying that's an old situation.
Mm.
That's already been happening. The actual doing of that, people being put in tubes and being managed, that's like taking the Matrix and making it your little hallucination, or fine-tuned for you.
Mm-hmm.
The way the Matrix presents it, most people say, hasn't happened yet. But in terms of verbal media, print media, and older media, and people's identities based on those older media, it's already happened, in terms of the disappearance of private identity. But the sticking of people in tubes, that hasn't happened technically.
Mm-hmm.
And that scenario horrifies people and cultures. And that's probably partly why we're having a war between cultures that aren't experiencing the 90s Matrix as much as North America has.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Right. So that is a crisis. We don't want to belittle it. But we're not even beginning to maybe misdirect it or stop it or make it acceptable and more comfortable outcome.
Maybe the Taliban saying, what's the difference if we blow up this world or we blow up the fake world you guys make and stick us inside of?
Yeah. So we aren't defining what we're up against very well. Now, the other factor is that new energy sources like cold fusion may move us out of the Matrix world or may move us into it. But most people's images of the horror of that aren't horrifying enough. But we already have been, as far as most people's private identity, lost that.
Mm-hmm.
The image of being put in a tube makes you think you're a nothing and you're living a fake environment. That's been happening through most of the 20th century. So what is really frightening about the tube? What do we think is being wiped out there? Because what we think would be wiped out was wiped out a long time ago. So that's why we have to say that we're already in the Matrix.
Yeah.
In other words, the horror of where we're at now, the post-information world, can't be expressed in any models. Now, that would be pretty horrifying, because then you got to deal with the fact that there's no common basis for organizing social action to determine which way our culture is going to go. Mm-hmm. There's nobody able to match on any level with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
That would explain why we're in the caveman reality of just beat the other guy over the head.
Yeah.
Which is what we're having now. In other words, this decade, it's public images of what is apparently happening, the war on terror and all the horrors that people think are happening as a result of that administration. That is a result of the matrix conditions of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like at the end of the Matrix, the third one, when they come out of the machine run world and they kind of have a victory.
Mm-hmm.
They arrived in the year 2000. If they made another movie, they might show how they didn't arrive at that place and that it was very primitive battle conditions that were going to happen now in this new idealized situation that happens at the end of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Well, towards the end of the movie, there was that interesting scene where Neo meets the Godhead, and the Godhead is like, you know, 100 TV screens all talking to him.
The TV body.
Yeah.
And have you ever heard my analysis? You ever read my Matrix interview, the second one with Guffey, where I explained that ending?
It would be good to hear that.
Yeah. So you have him looking at the TV body, and Neo is in the interval between the TV body, and he's warning the TV body about the chip body, represented by the millions of that secret agent guy, the guy with the sunglasses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, remember be a million of him?
Right, Smith, Mr. Smith.
Yeah, Agent Smith. So Agent Smith represents a million emails or a million transmission of one's... When you send out an email, it goes to a bulk mailing to a million people. You're sending a bit of you out to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's the image of Agent Smith. So Agent Smith is a chip body. So the triumph of Neo was that he was able to play off the TV body with the chip body, get them fighting each other, and he slipped through the interval.
Mm.
And I'm saying slipping through the interval is the arrival at the year 2000 after the battle of the chip body and the TV body.
Wow.
And it totally fits the imagery, doesn't it?
Yeah. So does that imply that the Wachowski brothers are almost caught up with Bob, but still lagging?
No, they have no clue what I'm talking about, but the Android meme which they're expressing is supporting Bob's scenario.
Yeah. Of course, that was based on a Philip Dick. Now, you think Dick had it was pretty hip to Bob, Philip Dick?
No, he was only in the Thompson Quadrant.
Mm.
He had scenarios based on I call the holopathic computer phase.
Oh.
And, you know, his interaction with aliens and that's all within the Universal Government Thompson Quadrant.
Right.
He had too much of a hologramic nature of a conflict. It was almost a theatrical replay of the theatrical state of mind of the Greeks, where you and the collective, the new individuals up against the old collective, the old tribe. And he did that within the metaphysical or ontological question of what's real and what isn't.
Yeah.
As he interacted with the empire.
Yeah.
Which he thought was something started at the time of Christ, that the Holy Roman was a hologram that never left. Well, that's the conditions in 67 to 72. But once you get into, and that leads to the fractal imagery, but past the fractal, you get into the Croker scenario of MySpace, and no MySpace can match with any other space, so that's called anamorphic. That's not fractal. Fractal is micro mirrors the macro. But the anamorphic is more fragmented, and that's the Croker phase that comes after Dick.
The anamorphic exists within the holographic, though, because as you move from one octave to the next within the holographic, you move through anamorphic spaces before you get to before you refocus on the pattern that you just left on a larger or smaller scale, depending on whether you're going macro or going micro.
Right, and the space you move through is enhanced in the digital phase. The tactile interval is what the Android meme and the chip body gives you. You are in between all the different old media spaces,
yeah.
Right? So it is a world of the in-between.
Yeah.
And so, Neo is in a new post-digitally supported in-between world. He's in a world that's off or post-information, and he can play off the chip body and the TV body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
This is the anachrony of that movie is that when Neo begins, it's either in the second movie or third movie, he begins by being in the subway. I think it's the third movie. He begins by being in a subway. He wakes up in a subway.
Yeah.
That's Bob spending the 90s in New York subways.
Yeah.
So you should read that part of the interview. It's near the end, I think. If you haven't read it, it's pretty interesting how I explain the situation.
Mm-hmm.
That the Android meme is really communicating, channeled through his dupes, the Wachowski brothers.
Is that up on Five Body?
I don't know. But you can just go
maybe
to the
Paranoia has it.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, in a recent, you know, did you look at the conversation with Joan of Arc?
No.
Yeah, well, there's a whole thread on aliens, and in there, Joan of Arc posts the two articles.
Okay.
So if you just follow the Joan of Arc stuff within the aliens thread.
On the Five-Bodied or the Bon Echo?
On the Five-Bodied. We don't. Okay. Nobody's on the Bon Echo anymore.
Oh, okay.
We don't do much there.
All right. Okay.
I mean, Andy designed Bon Echo to be a transition to whatever was going to happen, and then Five-Bodied turned out to be what happened, and she never intended Bon Echo space to be the final destination, so she doesn't mind, and I told her that I'm not duplicating posts there anymore. We're moving away from that.
Oh.
It's a great repository of a lot of stuff for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
But we do everything on Five-Body basically now.
Okay, cool.
So we covered several McLuhan quotes there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All trying to explain and update the image of what is Big Brother.
Right.
And so that's page 7. So you see how I positioned them, these four quotes after the initial de Chardin use of the word Big Brother.
Mm-hmm.
And then the whole page is trying to get you to understand it. Let's read the next quote from the letters. This was written about 1950, 51. Look at what McLuhan says again about implying about the Orwellian world and the cliche images. Can you read that, where it says current illusion?
Current illusion is that science has abolished all natural laws. Nature now pays 5,000,000%. Applied science now the master userer. To hell with our topsoil. We can grow potatoes on the moon tomorrow. How you grown to expose that? Well, there's...
How you going?
How you going to expose that? Well, there is still human life on the planet.
Now he puts life in quotes. So he's saying in 1950, this is page 219 of the letters, approximately, we don't have the exact date, but around 1950, 51, he's saying that because people still think there's human life on the planet, they're not going to believe that pollution will rain on the planet because the scientists understand that they can build a rock and go to another place.
Mm-hmm.
They feel that they can control nature, that they can overcome the nature's problems. And yet it's very hard to communicate that to people who still think they're alive. So he's saying that...
Well, it's a ridiculous statement. I mean, I don't know if I'm playing devil's advocate or I just can't wrap my mind around this, but how can you postulate that there's no human life on this planet?
Because now we have to look at what the word life is. It's quoting.
Yeah.
So remember, for McLuhan, human uniqueness is communication.
Yeah, I would say he's putting on the Android meme here. From the vantage point of the Android meme, something like that could be said, I suppose.
Yeah, the where the humans are marginalized. We were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
The cloning ESP phase is where humans are marginalized. The voluntary digital phase, humans are not marginalized. They're made to feel superior to the media, and it's servicing them. But this is, McLuhan used to say back then also, the big question is not is there life after death. The question now is there life before death?
Mm-hmm.
Same statement as this. People still think there's life.
That's a hard nut to crack. I mean, it's going to take a bit of explanation to get me to have a satisfactory understanding of what anybody could possibly mean by saying that. I see life all around me.
Yes, so did Neo in The Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
But what is life? Have you had a meaningful relationship or conversation, or do you feel you're part of a community? Think of the chemical body Eternals. Community, involvement, recognition, service, exploitation.
Mm-hmm.
None of those aspects are achievable in over an extended length of time by 1950.
Mm.
You may get them for 5 years, but then it'll be pulled out from under you, depending on what thing I was referring to.
Yeah. Well, you and Connie are not the only two people that have sustained a meaningful relationship over a lifetime. I mean, there are still people out there doing it. They may be in the minority.
I don't know if they we sustain it under conditions of knowing that there's no life on the planet. Most other people who sustain a relationship believe there is life on the planet.
Mm.
And so then the next quote, just to further, the whole page is illustrating.
Well, this last quote, I mean, nature now pays 5,000,000%. What is he saying there?
Well, the user, it's like we used to pay to nature. Now nature, the chemical body, is paying all the debts to the new TV body or the new technological simulacrum, because that, the simulacrum, is the master usurer. It's the one applying the usury or demanding the usury from nature.
Oh.
Nature's being consumed and thrown away. To hell with our topsoil.
Mm.
To hell with the pollution effects. McCool was talking about pollution before Rachel Carson came along, you know, 10 years before. But he says you're not going to be able to tell the managers the Android meme early phase, Clone ESP phase, you're not going to be able to stop it from consuming the planet, because it has members who believe they can build a new planet off this planet, another place, get on a rocket and go somewhere else.
So he's paraphrasing what he thinks are in the mind of the managers. To hell with our topsoil, we can grow potatoes on the moon tomorrow.
Right, right. Oh, you thought that was his opinion.
I don't know. I don't know where he's coming from when he says that.
No, no, he's talking about their attitude. Then he says, how are you going to expose that? Meaning that's not his view, because he's going to try to expose it.
Right.
But how do you expose the humans who believe, who will be naive to think the managers wouldn't be that evil?
Right.
Two people say that. Well, they're not doing that. They're not. The oil companies or car manufacturers don't believe that there's no global warming.
Yeah.
They understand. They read all the science stuff. Most people think that they're up against people who are a little stupid but still reasonable and concerned about saving life on the planet.
Right.
Look at the next paragraph. The next item, written in 1951, because he quotes an article in Life magazine, he says, he's writing a letter to someone. This is page 219, the same letter. Same page, or maybe the same letter, I'm not sure. Probably the same letter. He says, war assets issue. So some Life magazine issue on the war, Korean War assets. Pin-up girls featured as major asset. He says, I have tried italicized. I have tried in forthcoming March, Mechanical Bride. So he's saying in his new book, which he worked on since 1946, in forthcoming March, Mechanical Bride, to devise a technique for elucidating this scene. I've tried to come up with a way of showing that there's no human life on the planet. The scene, it can't be satirized. Trouble with duffers like George Orwell is that they satirize something that happened 50 years ago, and they claim it's a threat of the future. But it isn't. It's something that happened in the past. The threat is coming on. The effect is narcotic if you use George Orwell's scenario.
Right. Because you'd be if you were absorbed in believing his scenario, it's like a narcotic. You'll never see what's really going on.
Yes, if you believe Orwell's scenario. It's a form of nostalgic reaffirmation now. Now, then on the letters, the next quote.
Let me ask you, I got a question about Mechanical Bride. I know during the 50s and 60s there were people who were exposing the subliminal symbolism in advertising, the way in which Madison Avenue was using ancient archetypal ceremonial symbology and weaving it into products and advertising as a way of hypnotizing the general public. And now the Mechanical Bride, I had a copy of it. I didn't read it, but I looked at it. It was full of pictures, and the pictures all seemed to represent, to me, I was wondering, was Marshall trying to point out these, the way in which symbols manipulate the chemical body consciousness, or was that book not about that at all?
Yeah, he was doing that. He was talking about how, not symbols, he was talking about environments narcotize people.
Mm.
It's an early version of a mechanical understanding media. It's an early version of understanding media from a point of view. He didn't adopt a point of view in the later book, 10 years later.
Mm.
So, let's see.
So he Yeah, so that book was obsolete by the time Understanding Media came out.
Well, he says Mechanical Bride was obsolete the day it came out, 1951, because TV was coming in, and TV knocked the Mechanical Bride off the pedestal and created a totally new situation and relation between the sexes. He said basically he created the disposable juju girl. In other words, people weren't hypnotized by the woman on the pedestal. Now women were exploitable, expendable, what he called a disposable juju or a disposable piece of candy. And that began in 1953 with Hugh Hefner in Playboy magazine.
So the Mechanical Bride was obsolete by 45 when television started to become environmental?
No, TV doesn't become environmental in the States by 50, 51, 52.
Oh.
It doesn't become environmental till late 50s in Canada,
mm-hmm.
A little later. And by the mid-50s. Anyways, you say America by 1950, the States, Canada by 1955. So the Mechanical Bride is obsolete in America by 1951, 52, when it comes out, by the TV environment and the whole new effects. Women were no longer put on a visual space pedestal. So we then go to the next quote, which is from page 222 of the letters, where he's talking about the role of Wyndham Lewis in relation to this Orwellian situation. He says, Wyndham Lewis's The Art of Being Ruled, which came out about 1927, McLuhan said, is probably the most radical political document since Machiavelli's Prince. And he's writing this letter to Harold Innes. But whereas Machiavelli was concerned with the use of society's raw material for the arts of power, Lewis reverses the perspective and tries to discern the human shape once more in a vast technological landscape which has been ordered on Machiavellian lines. McLuhan is saying that Lewis was looking for the services and seeing the coming AP dimensions, anthropomorphic dimensions the android meme would prop up. He may not have seen it that far, but he was trying to point out how there were a lot of services in the new media environment, and people like Orwell and that were diverting you from an accurate understanding of what resources were available with the new technological disappearance.
Yeah.
So Lewis is, within the ordering of this page, Lewis is, represents the a different way of looking at the environment once you get past the Orwellian hypnosis.
Right. So do you think Orwell was just a guy who believed in what he was writing, or do you think he was commissioned by British intelligence as part of a propaganda hoax to, you know, to keep people stupid and allow the oligarchs to continue their agendas?
Well, that's LaRouche's view, that Orwell was a conscious, pretty conscious agent for the British oligarch's projection for the second half of the 20th century. I think it would be pretty hard to prove that. And so that we don't get diverted into trying to prove that, I would say that Orwell thought, because he was an old-fashioned guy, he was preserving values of language and speech. That's why he satirized the newspeak. He was trying to maintain the POB, the print-oriented Gutenberg European version of society, of creativity and intellectual growth and intelligence management. That was a 19th century vision. The best of the 19th century, the ideals of the print world and the newspaper world, for organizing a better situation for the chemical body. But he had no inkling of the new electric or TV body. First TV landscape, body is later, right? He had no implication of the services, or he didn't see how there were services in the new electronic landscape that the values of the POB were not were not relevant to. There are new services that, within the range of the POB's imagination, it wouldn't be applicable. Wouldn't be an accurate way to gauge one's relationship to it, or even the tribe or nation's relationship to this new situation. So Orwell was somebody projecting rearview mirror concerns. And to the degree that the Tetrad managers, after World War II, understood the new landscape, then he was a useful fool in getting people distracted and concerned about issues that McLuhan is trying to show in the previous par- weren't even concerned about the chemical body anymore. They could preserve it on another planet.
Yeah. So he might have thought he was being original, and then they came in and propped him up. Oh, yeah, we can use this guy. We'll pump a little, prop him up a little bit.
Or they let the acceptability to the average citizen, and what, since they're living in the rearview mirror, what he's projecting as the future, as a threat of the future, the average person would agree with it because they couldn't see the actual present. So,
right.
Well, whether the him becoming famous was not necessarily managed, but once he was famous, it was not a problem for the Tetrad managers.
Mm-hmm. Right. And yeah, what was that aphorism about instead of divide and conquer, you just give them, keep feeding them what they want because it'll keep them distracted?
Yeah, now, that, as a grammarian, we'd update that. You keep them involved in earlier media.
Mm-hmm.
You don't deal with the coming digital world and its implications that the managers were thinking about in the 50s and 60s, the Tetrad managers.
Right.
So that you don't have to work hard at giving them what they want. They're already operating in previous environments, or they're engaged in new environments, the TV environment, but they don't see the implications of it in the new accurate grammatical terms. They see it in old rearview mirror terms. They think television is just a whole bunch of more entertainment. They don't see how the form is going to alter their children, alter the society, and alter the economy, and create new kinds of entertainment they want, that people won't even like.
Yeah.
So the 50s had a kind of entertainment level that people liked, even though Elvis interrupted that a little bit. By the middle 60s, the entertainment that the new rock world was presenting, the psychedelic world, was not entertainment for the TV, happy TV consumers of the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And that created a reaction of the beginning of the neocon conservative and backlash of the hard hat mentality against the new youth counterculture, which was a product, the counterculture, of the satellite TV mix.
Wow.
So we've done page 7.
Mm-hmm. We got to finish page 9 before we go back to LaRouche because we did page 8.
Okay. All right, so continuing McLuhan here.
Oh, one thing you mentioned, you said the Tetrad managers. Did Marshall's insight help to create the discipline of Tetrad management, or was he just giving a name to what he already saw was going on with the Tetrad managers?
Okay, now state that again, because he wasn't using the phrase Tetrad manager, but you're talking about McLuhan in the 50s?
Yeah, you said the Tetrad managers were doing their thing, and I'm saying, well, did the Tetrad managers, was that an interdisciplinary way of managing culture that these guys were onto, and they were working within it, and then Marshall came along and said, you know, wrote about it, and so he made it public and blew the whistle on it, or was it because of Marshall's concept of the Tetrad manager that the manager said, oh, we got to go become Tetrad managers because we think this Marshall guy must be onto something?
No, the management of the world after 1945 was not interdisciplinary, it was intermedia. They let people think they had nations and elections, and they either had a communist or socialist or a democratic society.
But you're saying the managers were consciously aware that they were Tetrad managing. It wasn't like there was no such thing as a Tetrad manager before McLuhan came along, and then they all said, oh, we got to learn how to do what he's talking about. They were already doing Tetrad managing, and then Marshall came along and wrote about it, and thus, in a sense, blew a whistle on what they were already doing.
Well, I was there, and I saw how they did on the Secret Council 10. And what happens when you're in a position of global management responsibilities? The new environment dictates new situations that mandates you to change your management style.
Mm-hmm.
And the first beginning on the popular level, the effect of the TV world and the coming post-World War II world was the cancellation of democracy with the 1947 legislation in the United States, the National Security Act, where it was agreed that the Tetrad managers, though they didn't use that word, the CIA, the Pentagon, the military, could lie to the people. Did we discuss this in previous?
No, No.
So the National Security Act, which said that the president can lie to the people, no longer going to represent them, he's going to manage them.
Mm-hmm.
And so once you had the rights of the government to lie to the people, because the issues involve too many post-tribal subtleties that you knew the tribes couldn't have a sensible reaction to the situation because of the media blitz, so you had to manage the world by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the Secret Council 10 and the subsidiaries of that, the CIA, FBI, KGB, MI5, MI6, and all the other intelligence agencies, that's what they understood. They knew they were no longer operating within the national boundary.
Mm-hmm.
But you had a growth of nationalism in the third world in the 50s and 60s, right? A lot of tribal nations were allowed to form. The British Empire withdrew. That's because it moved into the TV landscape for the source of power, and then the later digital. So McLuhan pointed out what the Secret Council 10 already knew by instinct. And when he started to write about this in 53 and 54, they sent me in to prevent a clear understanding of what he was presenting, because he was educating people to see how the tetrad management situation that had arrived could be possible.
Yeah.
Could not be proven that that's what was happening, but if you understood the new medium demand a new kind of management, like he says in Understanding Media, the moving, what people call scandals, McLuhan says is not a scandal from the tetrad management point of view. You have to move people around, you have to lie to people to keep everybody, the Warren Commission did the right thing.
Uh-huh.
Didn't want to cause a civil war by pointing out, you know, who did it within the government. So the idea was to lie. That was a good move. Because people just were too involved in their chemical body issues and weren't aware. It's not their fault, just it takes a long time to become aware of new environments. They weren't aware of the TV body issues.
So they probably consulted psychologists or psychiatrists that knew about mass psychology. And
they invited McLuhan and Carper into one of the MKUltra meetings in 1952, before they even got their Ford Foundation grant in 53. Carpenter talks about it in his appendix to Donald Thiel's book.
Mm-hmm.
The book, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, talks about how the CIA moved in, took over anthropology and management of people's sociologies and psychologies. So that was normal and necessary. Now, your question was...
Did Marshall coin the term tetrad manager?
No, I did. He just came up with the term tetrads. But the description of management by tetrad is what the Secret Council 10 did. They didn't call it the tetrad,
right.
but looking at what was enhanced, what was obsolete, what was retrieved, and what flipped into, that process was understood. You know,
and they understood that instinctually before Marshall came along, and then they realized, oh, this guy's formulating it into words and educating people about what we're doing.
Yeah, so we're going to have to stop him.
So, but
and they did.
They did stop him. Silenced him.
They silenced his public image. I mean, he was dropped like a hot. He became famous in the mid '60s, and by '69, reviewers were sent out to put down his book and his latest books, and Jonathan Miller did that book on McLuhan, came out in 1971, which was a ridiculous book, but said he originally, 5-6 years before, was enthusiastic about McLuhan, but now he realized he was mistaken.
But within the small environment of the classroom and the university, he was allowed to continue to develop his thinking, and then they were watching him to see what they could learn from him.
Right. But he still traveled around the world and lectured, but being to enter into the Android meme and be a figure like Henry Kissinger standing with the president, they prevented that, McLuhan moving to that level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which he could have if he was allowed to give more time and present his stuff.
If they wanted to prop him up in that way, they could have.
Yeah, but they couldn't have. So they couldn't.
But they would have had to endorse him.
Yeah, when he went to the Bilderberger meeting in '69, he was a scandal.
Yeah.
He wasn't polite to anybody or to the host, Prince Bernhard, and he insulted his wife, the Queen of the Netherlands.
Oh, boy.
And he made fun of George Ball on the airplane coming back. He made fun of Dean Rusk at a restaurant.
In the way that he wrote about the events afterwards?
No, in their face. You don't know the stories?
That sounds like danger, like being foolish. That sounds like being belligerent to a police officer.
Or it's being a saint. What is the famous story of the guy, Daniel with the lions, and some of those biblical stories?
Yeah.
Or Jesus going in and turning the temple, what were they called? The moneylenders in the temple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, that's being pretty courageous.
Wow. Do we have time for one of those stories?
Yeah, the main stories are that the Queen of the Netherlands was the wife of Prince Bernhard, who was a World War II Nazi, who was a double agent, and he ended up marrying the Queen of the Princess and she became the Queen of the Netherlands, so he was like Prince Philip in relation to Queen Elizabeth. He had a lot of status. He helped form the Bilderbergers with David Rockefeller in 1954. So he was a major part of the IG Farben Big Brother network. So he hosts this meeting in 69, and in the social gathering at one point, McLuhan is talking to the Queen of the Netherlands, and he's telling her Polish jokes. And she's Polish. Mm-hmm. There's a Polish background. Okay, so that looked pretty scandalous. McLuhan was pretending to be oblivious to Polish jokes and their impact on a Polish person.
Right.
The next story, he's with Dean Rusk in a restaurant, and Dean Rusk is complaining about Pierre Trudeau and Canada's lack of contributing to NATO, that Canada should put more into NATO.